Okay, we'll start in one. Well, I see on my computer it's already 9 o'clock, so why don't we begin? Especially since a number of people have emailed me, so I just want to spend maybe 10 minutes responding to various comments. This is the third class we'll be doing on Rav Chaim Hirschenson. We might finish him today. If not, we'll finish him certainly within the first 15 minutes of the next class and move on to Rav Nissim. But let me just respond to, just briefly, to some of the comments, especially since I know from the emails, many of the comments come from these sort of responses. People find them interesting. Someone wanted me just to elaborate a bit. They weren't clear what I meant by, I showed you the writings of Rav Herzog last week and the memorial volume devoted to him. I believe that in the 20th century there are only three figures about whom you could have an entire volume with scholars speaking about different aspects of the individual's thoughts, and that is Rav Soloveitchik, Rav Herzog is probably the only one of whom you could have a whole volume devoted to different aspects of his halachic thought. Perhaps Rav Kook also. That is why they're so significant, because all the other great figures certainly are great, but they don't open themselves up to such forms of investigation. And we see now Rav Herzog is so wide-ranging in so many different ways that from the base, his basic writings, you get an explosion of discussion and of interest. It's very rare to find that. Another person asked me just if I could say something about the rabbis going to the Broadway shows. Someone was surprised that I said it last week. Okay, so let me just talk a little bit about American Orthodox history, not just American, German as well. I wasn't speaking about Gedolim, incidentally. I was speaking about rabbis, but plenty of Gedolim went to opera and the like also. But the fact is that, and I'm sure anyone who's over 35 can attest to this, that this was very common in the American Orthodox community, and not just in the modern Orthodox community, even in what became the Haredi, going to shows and the like. And I don't just mean Fedor on a Roof, but certainly in the modern Orthodox community, shuls would sponsor trips there. The rabbis would go. My shul in West Orange, a very big shul, in the early 1980s, put on a production of Fiddler on the Roof, something which certainly would never go today. And this went in line with the shuls all having dances and the like. Today, the only two shuls left that have dances, as far as I know, are Spanish and Portuguese, and KJ, Kalef Jeshurun. The Jewish Center got rid of theirs when they hired the last rabbi. Yeshiva University, to this day, sponsors a yearly fundraising trip to the opera. You see, can see the big ad every year in the Jewish Week, and Rabbi Meir Schiller has written about what this says. But in terms of the women singing, this was standard at all the Orthodox schools. Ramaz is, I think, the only one that still does it. They rely on a responsa by, or an article by Rabbi Saul Berman. But if you go to the typical modern Orthodox school, you'll still have girls singing. It'll be in groups. Although I can tell you from having been there, the heter, the leniency, is this notion that the two voices are not heard. But that means that you don't hear any of the voices in particular. You just hear them all together. And I can tell you that, having been at these events, that you don't have that at all. Maybe they don't understand, but you have the girls singing openly, and you have some little background music. Now, according to the Saul Berman approach, the other approach, in which it's only sensual songs that are forbidden, well, there's no reason to have the background singers just humming along at all. And according to the other approach, that it's all absolutely forbidden, the background singers don't do anything because they're having solos here. I mean, it's not my place to point this out to them, but as I'm just in the audience, but that's the reality, that's the fact. Now, Maimonides used to have women singers at their dinners, at least they did at one dinner. Seth Farber documents this. Teenage girls used to sing solos at Hirsch's school in Frankfurt. So you see, this is, this is hardly a simple matter, and it's there have been changes and developments. But the idea that 40 years ago that Orthodox synagogues sponsored these types of shows, that's part of American Orthodox history. One other comment. I was asked about, just in an email, I just want to briefly about, I had mentioned something in the past, this, if some of you are older than me, you could maybe enlighten me. There was this controversy over the Zim shipping line, in which Rabbi Soloveitchik threatened to put a chayrim on it, because they were going to put it in a kosher and a non-kosher kitchen, and then they got some rabbi to go along and do it, and then he backed out. I mentioned the name Rabbi Samuel Walkin. And someone wanted more details. He is the son of the Rav of Pinsk, Aaron Walkin. Here's actually a picture of him. I don't know if you can see it, with the top hat. This is a whole article about him putting Hashkacha on a different shipping line, a Greek shipping line. This is from I'm holding a newspaper here from 64, and he did put Hashkacha on Zim line. There's no question about that, at least according to my sources, but I might have been wrong in saying that he was the rabbi that Rav Soloveitchik was upset about. In the week I had to look into this, I haven't been able to determine if he was putting Hashkacha on before Zim caved, because what happened was Zim then got rid of the treif kitchen, apparently, and but there still was issues of Shabbos. I don't know. So I take back what I said about Rabbi Walkin. Simcha, you went to Camp Masad, so you can certainly testify to what went on there. Finally, a couple more things. We mentioned Rabbi Shmuel Yudalevitz last week. Now, there's a website in Hebrew called Hyde Park, which has all sorts of discussions about Gedolim and Svarim, and believe it or not, last week there was a discussion about Rabbi Yudalevitz, and someone posted this amazing picture. This is Rabbi Yudalevitz. And the other rabbi on the right, I forget. I can send anyone a link to it. I mentioned Rabbi Yehuda Herzl Henkin, and he has a response about the Orthodox minyan at Brandeis calling up Rabbi Axelrod, the Reform rabbi. It was asked by me. Those who want to see it, it's in B'nai Vanim, Volume 2, Siman 9. Here's the book, B'nai Vanim. The title is Calling Up a Heretic to the Torah in an Emergency Situation, and only on page 34 does he start speaking about the Hakempis and the Orthodox advisor and all this. You have no way of identifying who it is, and I will say, just for those who have kids at Brandeis, for the sake of accuracy, that Rabbi Axelrod has many zechuyot. It's because of Rabbi Axelrod that Brandeis University now has the largest Orthodox attendance in the country, other than YU. It's the only university in the country, other than YU, that has an Erev, that has three kosher meals a day, that has a base medrash in the university, not in the Hillel building. He has a lot of zechuyot, and there's many more, but the response is about him, and it's historically interesting. Okay, that's very interesting, Simcha. Yeah. Okay. I mean, well, I can give you more history of this if you're interested. Now, I mentioned to you how Rabbi Yehuda Herzl Henkin is the problem in his book, and that he doesn't give the details, who it's being written to, the circumstances, and this is very important. First of all, even halachically, it could be important. A responsum given to some place in the middle of nowhere has different implications than if it's in New York City. So I wrote to, and I mentioned how important Rav Moshe Feinstein's tshuvas are in this regard. The tshuva I just mentioned from Rabbi Henkin, if it had my name and if it described Brandeis University, I think this would be very historically interesting. So I wrote Rabbi Henkin right after the class, and I said to him, I'm curious, how come you don't include the names of people you write to? Think how much Igros Moshe would be lacking if we didn't know to whom he sent the tshuvot. This is his reply. I disagree with your premise concerning the Igrot Moshe. Now, he's certainly a great lamdan, Rabbi Henkin. He's a great posek. Anyone who could say that my premise is incorrect, lacking in Igros Moshe, if we didn't know who the responsa were addressed to, that he doesn't see this as significant, just doesn't get it. We couldn't write the history of American Orthodoxy without knowing who the tshuva were addressed to. We know what's going on in Canton, Ohio. We know what's going on in Houston, San Francisco. If we didn't have the names, these could be responsive to rabbis in South America. I mean, Rabbi Henkin has tshuvot in which he writes to people and he criticizes what they write in their books. We don't know what the books are because we don't know who he's writing to. The back and forth between Rav Moshe and other poskim, without knowing who he's writing to, the whole thing would destroy the historical significance of it. And I mean, just look at Shuvos from medieval times. We don't know what cities they're written to. We can't do anything with them. So he's way off on this. But then as to his question as to why he, my question as to why he doesn't quote the names of the people, which is how all the responds to them. They tell you who they're writing to. And he told me I could read this online. Two reasons, he says. One, to avoid the problem of titles and honorifics. He has a response about how today everyone is regarded as Harav HaGaon and all this, and since he wants to be honest and he doesn't want to refer to someone as Harav HaGaon when he's not, he leaves it out. And second, I think this is most important, quote, people I disagree with, often brusquely, although not disparagingly, I hope, might not enjoy the publicity. Of course, the answer to that is to ask them, do you mind if I... but that's what he said. Yosef Zachariah Stern, look, there's been many, many discussions about honorifics, and and Rav Chaim Hirschenson, who were we speaking to, deals with honorifics as well. What can you do? That's certainly not a reason. Everyone knows today when you put in Gaon, it doesn't mean anything. What's the point? It doesn't really matter. If you read Rav Avadi Yosef carefully, you see, though, he distinguishes between Harav HaGaon, which is any rabbi, and HaGaon, Harav. And those are only the greatest ones. I understand he's not concerned, but, you know, we're concerned. And, okay, and one more thing. Finally, I was asked, I mentioned having found two responsa, which basically conclude that according to one approach, and they don't conclude one way or the other, ha ha maisa, but they say according to one approach, you can count women in a minyan, and I mentioned how significant that is, because this is something today, you can never conclude this. I don't want to reveal who the responsa are, I'm holding them here, but only because I want to write about them, and then it'll get out, and someone will beat me to it, and want to hold off on all this. It's a 19th century tshuvot. One is early 19th century. One is later 19th century. What's amazing is neither of them quote the Shulchan Aruch. The Shulchan Aruch mentions that you can't count a woman to a minyan, and the conservative doesn't accept this. Rabbi Galinkin, in his response about this, just sees the Shulchan Aruch as one opinion among many. For the traditional perspective, that's not the case. In any event, they both independently developed the idea that according to the position that prayer is a rabbinic commandment, which is the Ramban and others, there is no reason why we don't assume women are obligated just as much as men. In fact, one of these people says, Bevadai, certainly, according to this approach, women have the same obligation as men. Women can be counted in a minyan. They're obligated, umitztarfin la'asara gamkein. I mean, I don't know what's stranger, the fact that, you know, no one knows about these tshuvos, or the fact that they two tshuvos of 19th century post-scheme, neither of them fall back on the Shulchan Aruch. They leave it as an open question. If you go by the Rambam, you don't count it. If you go by the Ramban, you do. And at least in one of them, if I remember correctly, he leaves no doubt that he believes that, I could be wrong about this, but I think he believes that the Ramban is the better position. Of course, in his day and age, it was all theoretical because no women were coming to the minyan. I do know that Judith Hauptman would have loved to have had these two tshuvot here. He says as follows. In one of them, we hold that tefillah is the Rabbanan in accordance with the Ramban. And then he goes on to show that according to the Ramban, women can be counted in the minyan because women have the same obligation as men, without mentioning the Shulchan Aruch's position. So it's interesting. Okay, let us then move on to Rav Chaim Hirschenson, unless anyone has any comments on this. Okay, we ended last... Yeah. Well, I don't know who your bubby was, but you don't need to bring a proof from your bubby, wives of Gedol Yisrael, and I'm not just referring to Rav Soloveitchik, I'm referring to... it was almost impossible to find a Litvisher Rebbetzin in America from the 1920s on... not just in America, but certainly in America, who covered her hair. So that's a different issue. And I mentioned already, there's a sefer that speaks about it in America. But that's no chiddush. The chiddush would be to find one who did cover her hair. That really went on from about the 20s until the 1970s. From the heart of Galicia, okay, that's also it. But she wasn't a Rebbetzin. I'm more interested not just in the Hamonam. The women didn't do it in the Hasidic world. You have many who didn't either. but the Hasidic Rebbetzins all did. I'm interested more in the Rabbanim, whose wives didn't. We ended last class, and I said that this approach of Rav Chaim Hirschenson, some of you might find it as lacking in seriousness because he begins with a perspective and he goes ahead trying to prove it, and some of you might see this as a refreshing alternative to the, I don't know what you want to call it, the positivists, those who believe that Jewish law is a completely objective science and just analyze it and let the chips fall where they may. Hirschenson's constant theme is that by returning to the sources, the halachic sources, the Rishonim, the Talmud, and by examining them with an open mind, quote, there is no Torah law or statute that opposes the ways of true civilization. What is true civilization? Enlightened civilization. Now, when he says there's no Torah law that opposes it, he's speaking, I think, in generalities here. In theory, you could have there could be one or two laws that are problematic, but in general, anything that's problematic is not eternal Torah law. We just need to look at it, use our ingenuity, just like Chazal and the Rishonim did, and we will show how it can work in modern times. All that is regarded as cultured, as ethical, in modern times, or almost all, is in line with Judaic tradition and halacha. His only problem, therefore, is to show this and to prove it. To give one example of many, by the first decades of the 20th century, enlightened opinion had concluded that women's suffrage is the only proper way to go, not just in America, in Europe as well. It was a matter of basic justice that women have to be given the right to vote, and therefore, according to Hirschenson, it's obvious, since enlightened people, people of goodwill, since, to use more modern terms, to use Rav Kookian type terms, the revelation, although he opposed women's suffrage, but the revelation of this new idea that women must be treated equally as men in the public sphere, that has to be in line with Torah civilization as well. And to insist otherwise would bring the Torah into disrepute. So as whereas other rabbis looked towards manifestations of modernity and saw only problems, Hirschenson saw great opportunities. And his vision is of Torah marching hand in hand with the best of modern civilization. And again, let me apologize for the cold I have here. Let me say a few more words about Rav Chaim Hirschenson's search, his conscious search for leniencies in the halachic process. It's not, as you might assume at first glance, that he viewed Jewish law as a burden, and therefore was interested in lightening the load. That is more was the conservative approach. That's not his approach. He was concerned that in modern times, when only a minority observe halacha, and many who do observe it only in part, the halachic system could be used to delegitimize most Jews, to regard them as out of the fold, and to create a ghetto of Torah-observant Jews and abandoning the rest of the Jewish people. Faced with this phenomenon, Hirschenson's goal was to stretch halacha to make it as inclusive as possible. Well, you can ask, why? Why stretch it to make it inclusive? What do we gain? Maybe, on the contrary, we should be trying to build the walls higher and keep out the people who are not entirely committed. Hirschenson's reply is that it's not a question of raising or lowering standards. Jewish law is a system for the people, the Am. It's not for a sect. It's not a sectarian system. And it's a living system. And since it's a living system that's directed towards the people as a whole, it has to deal with reality. The standards of halacha in Jerusalem in the early 20th century or in Vilna in the 19th century, the mid-19th century, are very different than early 20th century America. And to try to apply the same halacha of 19th or 18th century Vilna or 19th century Jerusalem to 20th century America is actually violating the ethos of the halachic system, which has inside it the ability to stretch and move in and out in accordance with the civilization being dealt with. There's all sorts of concepts in Jewish law. Mutav shiyu shogin, that is better, let them sin unwittingly. Notions of emergency, shas adchak. The halachic system permits itself to expand in accordance with the population it is dealing with. And to declare that you're not going to be concerned with this population is to abandon the classical approach of Jewish law. Let me take another, well, the same issue we dealt with, the women's issue. Rav Chaim Hirschenson explains that how you deal with these issues will be very different in modern times in America than in a closed society like the land of Israel of 100 years ago. And it's not a question of Jewish law even. It's how Jewish law replies, because the issues that are going to be changed are not Jewish law almost exclusively. It's more practices that are attached to Jewish law, meta-halachic practices, not Jewish law. Let me take another issue. There is a long tradition of limud zechut, that is, of trying to justify sinners. That was always the approach of rabbis, of gedolim, in pre-modern times. In modern times, most of them fell away from this because they figured the sinners are rebels. They're reformers. They're rejecting the Torah. They're not our community. They don't go to our synagogue. And therefore, we don't really have a responsibility to them. But in a traditional society, when everyone went to the same synagogue, they were, even if they weren't that observant, more of a Sephardic type mentality, the idea was you try to justify violations as best you can. Hirschenson believes that this must remain the approach even in 20th century America. And he looks at Shabbos violation. That's the first thing he looks at, or the big one. You could look at all these Jews violating Shabbos in the early 20th century. That was, you had, Shabbos violation was rampant. And you could say these are all just sinners, these are all just people out of the fold. But many of these people wanted a connection to Judaism. As I mentioned before, you had early minyanim, 6 a.m. minyanim on Saturday, so people could then go and go to work. This is very standard in America. Are you going to regard these people as the classical Machal Shabbos, the one who's a brazen violator of the Shabbos? Chaim Hirschenson develops the idea. Yeah, exactly. Is it Lahachis or not? Although that was what we spoke about Ettlinger a few semesters ago. That's Ettlinger's Chiddush. According to the Talmud, they don't make that distinction, but Ettlinger argues that that's the implication of the Talmud. Hirschenson says that these people they're not willful violators. They're doing it because of their monetary situation. They feel, even if they're wrong, they feel that it's pikuach nefesh, that it's they need to work to live, and therefore we have to look at how they view the matters. Similarly, Hirschenson saw all these Jews attending synagogues who shaved with razors, and this goes back to the issue I raised last class. So he tries to find a justification, because his role as a posek is to bring these people in as best you can. We don't want to find a hetter for shaving with a razor in a society where no one does it, but in a society where everyone does it, if we can find a hetter, we will. He was confronted by Ritzi Pesach Frank in a letter about his attempts to justify the Sabbath violators with regard to wine, making wine. If a Sabbath violator touches wine, the question is the wine kosher or not? And there's a whole discussion. Here is a book by Tzvi Zohar and Avi Sagi, a whole book on this theme of the status of a Sabbath violator, in particular with regard to the wine issue, because this isn't just some arcane subject. Listen to the title of the book in English. Circles of Jewish Identity, A Study in Halachic Literature. The issue is, what is Jewish identity? Is it ethnic? Is it completely religious? If it's completely religious, then it's very easy to push people out. But if ethnicity is very significant, then Sabbath violation isn't enough, really, to push them out. It needs to be brazen Sabbath violation, etc. They have a number of pages on Rav Chaim Hirschenson's discussion of this issue. But listen to how he replies to Ritzi Pesach Frank. Ritzi Pesach Frank writes to him that Hirschenson argues that all the Rishonim would hold that a Sabbath violator, no matter why, does not make the wine undrinkable, and it makes perfect sense. After all, why can't we drink wine of a non-Jew? Because it's to prevent intermarriage. but you can marry a Sabbath violator's child. So they may, it would make no sense to say that a Sabbath violator, and this, by the way, is not found in the Gemara. This is a later Chiddush. And Rav Chaim Hirschman argued that this is something from the Achronim. So Rosi Pesach Frank pointed out that, no, you even have a Rishon who holds this. And the logic being that, look, once Chazal said that if you do this, it's as if you re, you have the status of a non-Jew, then it's a technical thing. We can't start asking, well, we can marry his children, so it doesn't apply. No, it's a technical matter. We treat him like a non-Jew, and that his wine is undrinkable. Although even there, I mean, this technical matter only goes so far. If I were to marry a woman who's a Sabbath violator, she still needs a get. I mean, Hirschman discusses this, Avi Sagi and Svi Zohar discuss it. But listen to what, after being confronted by one medieval authority who disagrees with his blanket statement that none of the medieval authorities apply this concept of Mechal Shabbos to making wine undrinkable, Hirschman replies, quote, if he, that is if this Rishon, felt the pain of the parents and children in America, he would have changed his opinion in order to draw them near and not push them away. What other post-sake speaks like that? They might think like this. It might be in the back of their mind. But he says explicitly that this opinion of the Rishon really is not applicable anymore. We're not going to bring it into the Beit Midrash because that doesn't bring people close today. Now, Tzvi Pesach Frank's letter is very respectful. We see that he has some relation to Chaim Hirschman. I don't know what. They obviously were married to people who were related, because he has the Shin Bet at the beginning, which is a sign of someone who's related. And we'll get back to this letter from Tzvi Pesach Frank, because historically it's very significant. In the Har Tzvi, this letter is included, the halachic section, but the historical part, how he describes what was going on in Jerusalem at the time, that is not included, for reasons we'll see when we deal with Tzvi Pesach Frank in a few weeks. Rav Chaim Hirschman does publish it, and had he not published it, we really would have a lack of understanding of really what was going on the Haredi community in Jerusalem. So I'll get back to that letter. I'm sure Tzvi Pesach Frank wasn't so happy that it was published, but what can you do? So he refers to Chaim Hirschman as Harav HaGaon HaMeforsom, giving him great praise. However, when Rav Avadya Yosef discusses the same issue, and he quotes Hirschman and quotes Tzvi Pesach Frank, he heaps abuse on Hirschman. He says that unlike Hirschman, Baruch Hashem, that I'm not at the level, that I haven't reached the level in quotes, that I'm going to take on and argue with Rishonim. I mean, you see, he really is annoyed at Rav Chaim Hirschman. Now, let me tell you something. Since what I just mentioned about Shabbos, that has not appeared in any of the literature, which is amazing, which it comes directly from the Chazon Ish, told to Rav Avraham Wolf, who was very close to the Chazon Ish, disappeared after the Chazon Ish's death in the newspaper Digleinu, which was a newspaper published in Israel, quoting the Chafetz Chaim, and you see that the Chafetz Chaim was very much like Rav Chaim Hirschman. It hasn't appeared in print. I've never seen it anywhere picked up in any of the hagiographies. They don't know about it, presumably. Here's the story, told by the Chazon Ish. There was a lot of Chilul Shabbos going on in Europe, as you all know, in the Chafetz Chaim's day in the 20th century, and there was a rabbinic convention in Grodno, and all the rabbis were there, and they wanted to come out with some declaration against working on Shabbos, and they asked the Chafetz Chaim to sign it as well, because if he were to write about it, they would encourage encourage people to observe Shabbos. It says, Ramrot Haftzarot Merubot, although they pressured the Chafetz Chaim to come out with this declaration condemning Chilul Shabbos by the Jewish workers, he refused to. Lo Hotziya Chafetz Chaim Shum Isur. The Chafetz Chaim refused to publish a statement in Europe, in Russia, declaring that how important Shabbos is and you shouldn't violate Shabbos. And he came out with many statements, the Chafetz Chaim, Taras Rishpacha and the like, but not this. Why? V'hatam. Meot Poalim. He goes on, hundreds of workers. who don't have work, Shrei Avodah, Miyom Oyom, Hareza Nogea V'Pikuach Nefesh. This is Pikuach Nefesh for them. V'him Shich Rabbeinu, and the Chazon Ish continued. Naniach She'achavetz Chayim V'atzmo, Haya Echad HaPoalim, Hayim Hayoveh B'Shabbos, Chas V'Shalom. Certainly, if Chavetz Chaim was one of these workers, he wouldn't have worked on Shabbos. V'vaday Shalo. U'v'chol Zot Lo Micha B'Pumdei. But he would not criticize these Jewish workers publicly. The Chazon Ish explains that Pikuach Nefesh is not a simple matter. It depends on the perception. These people, these workers, thought, you know, from their perspective, it was Pikuach Nefesh. They felt they needed to work to live. The Chafetz Chaim would have wandered from place to place and been a beggar. This is an amazing thing, testimony from the Chazon Ish, that the Chafetz Chaim refused to criticize them, knowing that they were basically good Jews, but they felt they had no choice. And he didn't feel it was his place or right to criticize them. I bet, although I don't know, I bet early 20th century America, you had these European rabbanim whose little shuls and shtiebels were filled with people who worked on Shabbos. I bet they didn't criticize them either. They understood that, you know, these people, it bothers them. It pains them that they have to work, but they feel they have no choice. And certainly the Rav felt differently, that they could have made a choice, and it's not really Pikuach Nefesh. It's so they have a roof over their head. Now, having a roof over their head is not really Pikuach Nefesh, technically, but I bet they never criticized their people for the very reason that the Chafetz Chaim mentions, which today people would find very difficult to understand, but this comes directly from the Chazon Ish. I think it's quite interesting. Let us move on. Another interesting approach of Hirschman's, and I touched on it two classes ago, let me return to it again. According to Rav Chaim Hirschman, there are no real principles of Jewish faith in the Maimonidean sense, no 13 principles and the like. The only real principles are God's existence and His unity, and I guess he would include also the Torah, because that's basic. But all the other things, they could be true beliefs, but not dogmas in the Maimonidean sense, that if you reject them, this is heresy. Hirschman believed that thoughts alone, as we mentioned, are never enough to condemn one. Only one who publicly voices their heresy. And he argues that the Torah, if this is such an important thing, why doesn't the Torah have any principles of faith in it? He says, whoever reads the Torah of Moses, which is founded on justness and righteousness, will find no mention of principles and articles of faith. This is shades of Shadal's criticism of the Rambam. There is only the unity of God. The reader will understand that the Torah did not wish to make these beliefs and hopes part of our legacy, because these are matters of individual feelings and not to be shifted from private to public. The primary principles of the Torah are righteous laws and judgments, national memories, and purity of body and spirit. Strong criticism, just like Shadal, of the Maimonidean approach of trying to set everything out. That at the end of the day, for Hirschman, the important thing is to do Torah and mitzvos. And yes, we have beliefs, and we put them forth, but they're more of the sense that these are things you should believe, because we believe these are true beliefs. But they're not dogmas in the Maimonidean sense, that denial of them is heresy, you're out of the community. These are true beliefs that we try to strive to, and we try to teach people about, but not dogmas. And this is not what the Torah is about. The Torah is not about setting up dogmas. Who's a heretic, who's not? The Torah is about righteousness and rachmanut and mitzvot and leading a good life. And that's why the Torah does not have these Maimonidean principles. There's a reason why it doesn't have it. Because these are extra. These are nice. These are something that add to Torah. But these are not basic to being a good Jew. Except, you know, things that if you don't believe in, we'll see Torah in a second. But if you believe that God is, there's multiple gods, then you're not believing in God. So you can't get to first base. But belief in God and His unity, that is all the pure theology that the Torah requires. And that's what the Raivad was all about. In the Raivad's famous criticism of the Rambam, he's not denying that the Rambam's correct, that God is not of a physical form. What he's saying is that it's not our job to declare people who think otherwise heretics. They're just mistaken. And the Torah doesn't set these things up. And the Riaz, Rav Isaiah of Trani, in his criticism of the Rambams, he says that if these ideas were so important, what the Rambam says, then Chazal would have established them. The Torah would have established them. Chazal never tell us that we have to believe, let's say, God has a physical God doesn't have a physical form or all these other principles. The Torah never tells us. That means that these are good things, perhaps, or definitely according to the Oz, but they're not dogmas. A dogma means if you deny it, you're out. If you accept it, you're in. We don't have dogmas in Chazal, really. You can count maybe two or three, resurrection, they include as a dogma, whatever that means. And there's one or two others, but you don't have Maimonidean dogmas, in the sense. And that's Ryan Hirschenson as well. I think it's obvious why Hirschenson is now undergoing something of a revival. People are looking for a figure, a halachic figure in particular, because he operates out of the halachic system. He's a halachist, first and foremost. They're looking for a halachic figure who comes on the scene with new conceptions, one who takes modernity seriously, and this leads him to approach problems and issues from a new perspective. He's not modern in the sense of fitting the halachic system into the modern world. He's modern in that he is completely reworking it because of the challenges of modernity, but reworking it in a way that's faithful to the halachic system. I don't think he would say he's completely reworking it, but I think, looking at it, he is reworking it in a way that's faithful to the halachic system, because he believes that much of what was stated in previous years is not relevant to today, and Chazal intended it to be this way. That is, the halachic system in and of itself has the ability to change. It's not a reform. We're not reforming the system. The system itself, it's built into the system to change in certain ways. He sees the halachic system not as something fossilized, but as able to expand and absorb the best new insights the world has arrived at. And the closest parallel I see to Hirschenson in modern times is Eliezer Berkowitz, Rabbi Eliezer Berkowitz, who hopefully we'll deal with in a future class. If you read Berkowitz's Hebrew book on Jewish law, or his English little English book on Jewish law, it's called Not in Heaven, you really get the exact same approach. Now you see tendencies of this in other people, probably in the Dor Revi, in Rabbi Moses Samuel Glasner, certainly in Rav Gorin you see it, but you really see it in Berkowitz. Berkowitz never became a leading posek, but he wrote about Jewish law, very similar. The difference is that Berkowitz was theoretical. Hirschenson is halacha maisa. Now, if we had more time, we would go into more detail of Hirschenson's views of halacha and women. Let me just point out, because I think it's interesting, it's not just in Jewish law and women that we see his apologetic sense, and that he comes to it from that side. And when I say apologetics, I don't mean in a bad sense. Apologetics gets a bad rap in traditional Judaism, but in Christianity, for example, apologetics is an honored field. What it means is that you provide justifications for the faith. Today, the word apologetics often means something not seriously, often even something that the other person stating it doesn't himself believe. You know, these rabbis sometimes get up and say things just to quiet the women, or, you know, say they don't believe it themselves, so we say it's apologetics, it's not serious. No one who knows anything takes it seriously, but that's not what really apologetics mean. Let me give you an example, though, where we might say that this is apologetics and have it in a negative way, but Chaim Hirschenson believed it with all his heart, also relating to women. One of the classic feminist examples of denigration of women in rabbinic literature is the statement that a woman's only knowledge is with the spindle. I believe, unless you are just so, I don't know what else to say, so brainwashed or indoctrinated, you have to assume and have to conclude that Chazal have lots of different statements about women. You have very, very positive statements, and then you have individual rabbis, because Agadatah, much of it is individual statements, who say negative things. Just like you have rabbis who say very negative things about the masses, the Hamonam, that real contempt for the Amaretz, and then you have other positions. As I think probably all of you know, rabbinic literature is so wide, so vast, that you can find opinions on all sorts of areas, which is why these disputes we have on Hashkafa and ideologies, Zionism and the like, they really don't make any sense, because fundamentally we have different approaches, and each of us are able to find good sources. Satmar Rav is able to find sources on his side, and the Zionists are able to find sources on their side, and no one source can veto another source. It's really your intuitive feeling that's going to push you in a certain direction. But here is a statement that has created much problems, because it seems to be a very negative approach towards women. So fine, you could say, well, this is one approach, and there's other more positive approaches. That might be the more objective way of looking at it, but not for Chaim Hirschenson. He believes that really, I assume he'd acknowledge there'd be some negative statements, but not this one. He writes, this is not in his Sfarim, as far as I can tell, but it's in one of his essays. He has a whole essay on women, defending the honor of the rabbis with regard to women in the journal Hamisterona. If you want to see this interesting journal, which has articles by Rav David C. Hoffman and many others, Berdyshevsky, it has recently been put on the website HebrewBooks.org, which, let me just, for a minute, because I've mentioned this a few times and people have written to me, they don't know. When I finished graduate school in 95, it was obvious to me that if I wanted to continue to do scholarship, I would need to be near a big city. And what is it? Near a big, great Jewish library. And the only places where you can have great Jewish library in America, of the sort that if you know my scholarship, you know that I like to use all sorts of unusual and rare sources. All you have is Boston, New York, and Cincinnati. Cincinnati is the Hebrew Union College. They have bought many books, and they also received the library of the late Rabbi Yehuda Greenwald, Leopold Greenwald, who's the Rav of Columbus. It's a long story as to how they got that. But he had the largest private collection, probably, or him and Freehoff, had the largest private collections of Sfarim, perhaps, in America. Unfortunately, I think I mentioned this, they burnt all of his Torah letters. He might have had the largest collection of letters of Gedolim also. So they got all of his stuff, and then Solomon Freehoff, who was the Reform Rabbi in Pittsburgh, he had the world's largest collection of responsa literature. You can see his writings, his book on A Treasury of Responsa and the responsa literature. These are great works. And then he has about 10 volumes of Reform responsa. These were donated to Hebrew Union College. But there really are no other great libraries. So in Cleveland, they have a nice library, and the Library of Congress also, I guess you could work there, but Harvard University buys every single Hebrew book printed in the world. And when I lived in Scranton, I would come into New York every other week to go to the library. Yeah, you would need to do this. In the last 5 years or so, tens of thousands of books have been put online. There are two sites. One is costs money, Otsar HaChachma, which has a better search engine, and that has about 30-some thousand. But I don't know what the future of that's going to be, because you now have a site, HebrewBooks.org. It began a couple of years ago, just books of American rabbis. And as of last year, this time, it only had about 14,000 books. Now, as of the last 2 months, it has over 30,000 books, all available to be downloaded. You can, if you want to print them, there's a thing there. You can get them printed for you very cheaply. They'll just bind them. We reached the point now where from your desk, no matter where you are, you have access. I think there's only been about 60,000 Hebrew books published, and now about 30-some thousand, Torah books, that is, and about over 30,000 are online. That includes many newspapers, rare newspapers. So you can sit at your desk and achieve all this. It's incredible when you think back to what people would need to do, and he started putting Haskalah stuff online, and they're probably going to have to separate that. Dov Friedberg, who has sponsored this site, the HebrewBooks.org site, told me that he told the director of it, who's a Chabad guy, that they should separate them, so we'll see what happens. I saw a statistic that 60,000, until let's say 1950, I don't know since then, there was about 60,000. Obviously, these are estimates. So you can see now Hamisterona online, and it's in Volume 3 for those who want to see it. What I'm going to mention right now, pages 295 to 296. It's an incredible democratization of scholarship, of our heritage. And I don't know what to say other than it's the riches are incredible. You could spend days just looking at that. The books that I've been to the greatest libraries in the world, but books that I've never seen. I've heard about, but I've never been Zocha to see, How could I? It turns out that many of them were at the Chabad Library in New York, and now the Chabad books from the great Chabad Library in Crown Heights are being put online. Books which there may be one or two copies in the world, because some of these books you don't even have them in Jerusalem, or at least one or two copies are publicly available. So we are living in incredible times. So what does Rav Chaim Hirschman say? Hey mem, like the Hebrew word, hey mem samach dalet resh vav nun hey, hamisterona. The sages, this is what Rav Chaim Hirschman says. The sages don't say that a woman only has a spindle, just that her knowledge is in the spindle. Most people look at this passage and would assume, what does it mean her knowledge is in the spindle? It means that that's all she could do, that's all she's good for, to sit home and sew. No, Rav Chaim Hirschman says that knowledge of the spindle is just Chazal's way of speaking in terms of general knowledge. The ability to make a living. The ability to make a living in dignity. This is Chachma with a spindle. And many well-known people, he says, have not achieved this. So he develops the whole notion that when Chazal say a woman's wisdom is with a spindle, it's praise of her. What it's saying is that women are able to make a living, and that women have this special ability of Chachma to make a living, to do this. They're able. Now, I don't know historically how accurate this is, but certainly in Rav Chaim Hirschman's day, you had plenty of women who ran stores and did things like that. And he's not being apologetic in the sense that he thinks that this is what Chazal had in mind, that, you know, the Gemara says, bina yatera, by women, that women have a certain, I don't know how to translate bina yatera, maybe a certain intuitive understanding, that they are blessed, that they have a certain ability, a certain skill to be involved in business, in the practical world. So he turns it on its head, as it were. So we see there how sensitive he is, and he's writing this in the 1890s. He hasn't come to America, he hasn't been exposed to a lot, but already then he senses that something, this passage needs to be interpreted differently. Yes, but he's going to, so a passage like that, Chaim Lander, but he's going to say positively, all this is positively, not negative. I mean, he has an interesting way. I mentioned the passage from Horayot, where it says that you save a man is first before a woman in terms of saving their lives, the hachayot. And Rav Chaim Hirschman says, a hachayot just means to feed. And he says, we don't even hold like this. We hold that you feed the woman first. That's an original approach. The people say, you save the man first because he can do more mitzvot. Rav Chaim Hirschman says, this makes no sense at all. Just because women don't have as many mitzvot to do, they have just as much right on life. And the reason we feed a woman first, according to the other opinion, is because a woman can't go begging. And according to the opinion that say we feed a man first, you could say because a man has to support a family, etc., etc. But he is convinced that what appears to us perhaps unethical or not or problematic, Chazal couldn't have meant it. And he says the Rambam doesn't paskin this, and therefore then this is the reason. He does not speak about Shlo Asani Isha, but if you look at Shlo Asani Isha is a modern problem. Because if you look in context, Shlo Asani Isha is that a man has more mitzvahs to do. So he's thankful for that. It didn't have the same connotations. It's not a man saying, I'm happy I wasn't made a woman because of something bad about women. You can find, you have passages, like a person who has daughters, you know, the problems. But that passage he doesn't see about. I think the context, and if you look at the Rishonim understand the whole notion of having more Kedusha because you have more mitzvos. That's how the Rishonim understand this idea. It's not in Chazal, but I think if you look in the context, it's in Menachos there. I think that's the Pshat. Not that, in that Gemara, that I believe is the Pshat. And that's how the Rishonim see this whole idea. Or not all the Rishonim, I'm sure, but standard Rishonic views. There is a Sefer, incidentally, called the author's name, Meshivas Nefesh. It's interesting how the pre-moderns could say anything they want to say, no problems. They didn't have to worry about being politically correct, and I won't even say being politically correct. They didn't have our same sensitivities. It's published by Rav Yochanan Luria, a German Rav from the 16th century. he just writes about how before Eve sinned, men and women were equal. But after Eve sinned, now woman is secondary. Man has to take control of her. And this is a common Rishonic view. Someone like Rav Chaim Hirschenson would say, this is an example of where great rabbis are influenced by their times, and they have distorted Chazal. You have to, though, be a Rav Chaim Hirschenson to speak that way. Simply, I don't know what that means. If you have to feed your animal first, so obviously you have to feed your, so you feed your animal first because you have to have mercy on the animal. But just because you feed your animal before you eat, it doesn't mean the animal is a higher level than yours. We're not talking about here, when I say to feed, I'm referring to saving the life, saving someone's life. If you have just enough food for a person or an animal, you don't feed it to the animal. That halacha is only talking about if you have lots of food, then you feed it to the animal. Let's now, and this is the second to the last issue I want to deal with, and Simcha, you raised this issue last semester, and I pushed you off, I said, hold off on it, we'll get to it, and we have arrived. And that has to do with the sacrificial system. Karbanos, exactly. Here, Rav Chaim Hirschenson is taking all these great ideas that we have to regard women as our intellectual equals. He's not talking in Stanley. He never speaks about changing halakha, giving women aliyahs, all that. He is a firm believer that there's different places for men and women. He's more concerned, though, with an ideological approach that devalues women. And certain how in his day, women didn't feel offended that they didn't go to they weren't counted in the minyan. You know, that was the man's place. But women were very offended if you told them they couldn't be involved in voting and things like that. And democracy and all these issues Rav Chaim Hirschenson sees as really great things, that we're living in an era of greatness, and Torah is going to be part of that era and assimilate these ideas, because these ideas are not in opposition to Torah. For Rav Chaim Hirschenson, there's no such thing as an absolute Torah society. That's really what he's getting at. In medieval times, Jews lived one way, so Torah responded another way. Today, Jews live a different way, and we should be thankful there's democracy, so Torah responds another way. We shouldn't want to live the way they lived in Abraham's day, where they didn't have electricity or anything like that. Similarly, we don't need to live the way Rishonim lived with regard to how women were, education, etc. That's his major thesis, that there's no absolute Torah society, but Torah responds to every society. And in many ways, our society today is better. In some ways, it's worse, but in many ways, it's better. And therefore, Torah is built up around this. Hirsch was very similar, incidentally. What then to do about karbanos? He raises the issue. He wasn't asked about it, but he thought it had to be raised because in his day, people, you know, with the return to the land of Israel, you had a lot of discussion. What about karbanos? People tried to revive Hirsch Kalischer. Let's start offering karbanos again. There was a lot of talk about rebuilding the Beis Hamikdash, and he raised the question, when we look forward to this future messianic era, he already dealt with the notion of monarchy, how this is not an absolute, what about sacrifices? And he says in Malki Bakodesh that the entire sacrificial system will undergo significant alterations in accordance with the mindset and conceptions that will then prevail, conceptions that today we can't grasp because we don't know what's going to be in the future. He is, incidentally, not the first to speak this way. There was a rabbi in Milwaukee named Scheinfeld. He was the Rav of the Orthodox community in Milwaukee. Maybe some of you are from Milwaukee. He published anonymous articles saying that there will be no return to a sacrificial system. Rav Chaim Hirschenson does not elaborate as much as we would like in Malki Bakodesh, but it's clear that he's saying that cultured minds of the future will not find meaning in the sacrificial system as it existed in days of old. And as Chaim Lander points out, the Midrash does say that everything except the Karban Torah, the Thanksgiving offering, will be abolished. In my book on the Rambam's 13 Principles, I have a whole chapter. I give all the sources on this. Since it's hard to imagine moderns finding any sort of spiritual meaning in the sacrificial system, although some will, but many certainly will not, Eliezer Schweid, the author of this book, Democracy and Halakha, is no doubt correct in saying that What Herfenson means is that in the future there will be absolutely no sacrificial rituals. Rav Kook has a passage in which he speaks about the mincha, the vegetable offerings will continue. The Todah is a meat offering, so that seems to contradict what Rav Kook's saying. By the way, in the future Svarimbog, I'll deal with this. I discussed the alterations to the sacrificial system in my chapter on the Rambam's principle that the Torah will never be revised in whole or in part. And I give Rav Kook's position in the Siddur that we will no longer offer these sacrifices, the Karban Pesach and the like, is an example of an alteration of the Torah and a violation of the principle. In one of the new Kvatzim, in one of the new writings of Rav Kook that just came out, Rav Kook deals with this, and he shows why what he's saying is not in violation of the Rambam's principle, because built into the, this is how they always get around it, built into the mitzvah from the beginning was that it's not permanent. So if it was built in this way, then you're not violating anything. Herschenson believes that worship will be spiritual in nature, revealing the inner meaning of the sacrifices offered in the past. So what that means is, I guess we would have a synagogue service which would reveal the inner meaning of what sacrifices meant in years past. Now, Rav Kook received this book. Rav Chaim Herschenson, who was a great admirer of Rav Kook, and they had a very good relationship, he sent the Malkim HaKadosh to Rav Kook, and Rav Kook writes back, and Rav Kook is very opposed to Rav Chaim Herschenson, says, here you have a steerer, a contradiction in Rav Kook. Rav Kook in his Siddur is very, radical in speaking of a future change in the sacrificial system, and in this letter to Rav Chaim Herschenson, he's very conservative with a small c. And I don't think you can say that in the letter to Herschenson he's speaking about the early era of the messianic times, and in his Siddur he's speaking about the later era, the more exalted era, because he doesn't make that distinction at all. I believe it's a contradiction in his writings. He says to Herschenson, don't be enamored by Western culture. Yes, Western culture regards sacrificing animals as an immature form of worship. Look, the Rambam also did. But we spoke about the Rambam, how the Rambam thought that it began immaturely, but it now has moved beyond that. He tells Herschenson that behind the physical act of the sacrifice, there is profound holiness, and that we cannot understand right now what the benefits of sacrifices are, and what it will mean in a messianic era, and it's premature, and it's irresponsible, Rav Kook is saying, based on our understandings in our era, to declare that in the future, in a messianic era, when our whole conceptions will be different, there won't be any sacrificial system. So that's a very strong criticism, and I think a valuable criticism, and a valid criticism, and yet Herschenson stood firm in his position. In fact, Rav Kook, as I just mentioned, thought that Herschenson has been taken in by what modern society regarded as intellectually respectable and cultured. And Rav Kook says that we don't go forward based on that. Herschenson defends himself by stating, and this is a quote, knowledge and discernment will not regress, and lack of culture will not be considered culture. In other words, Rav Chaim Herschenson starts with this assumption that all advanced notions that are accepted as basically all intelligent people assume these things, these are in line with Torah civilization. Since he assumes that enlightened people do not see sacrifices as a valuable approach to God at present, this is not something that you can't tell me, Rav Kook, that in the Messianic era this will change. This will not change. And if he wanted to develop it, he could have said, after all, the Rambam speaks really of no real changes in the Messianic era other than physical changes, that we will not be oppressed. Herschenson refuses to accept that. I mean, he can be so certain, and it's hard to say how you can be so certain, but he says that this is not something that will change. We are moving higher. We're getting closer to the Messianic era, so our forms of worship are becoming more exalted, not less, and we've moved beyond the sacrificial system, and therefore we will have zecher l'davar. We will have services that recall the sacrificial worship and derive things from it, but we will not be engaged in it ourselves. That's what he says. Quite radical. but he doesn't budge on this position. I see the time, we've already come to 10. There is one final point, also fascinating, which we'll deal with next class before we move on to Rav Nissim, and that is his tshuva and his analysis of biblical criticism, what is acceptable for Torah observant Jews, what it means, biblical criticism, from the standpoint of Torah. We will look at that next time. And so we'll stop here. We just have questions or comments. However often I look at what he says about sacrifices, I can't help thinking that perhaps this is really over the line. I mean, as the rabbinic aphorism says, "Shgaga yatsa mi'lifnei ha'shalit," that you know, the great man makes a mistake here. It just seems that it's such a part of our tradition to, I mean, it's one thing to say possibly, if he would say that we don't know what it's going to be, perhaps, you know, this is not something that will be brought back, but to be so definitive in opposition to so many trends in our tradition, that seems to me perhaps the most radical of everything he says, the abolishment of sacrifices. So, okay, any comments about Ephraim Hirshenson? Simcha, what do you have to say about this? No, he didn't offer a view on Matzitza B'Peh. That wasn't really an issue then, but if he had been asked it, you obviously know what he would have said. I was in Borough Park today because I had off today, so I went, I went to Beagle Eyes in the Sfarim store, and then I conducted another long interview with Rav Chaim Golevsky, who I mentioned in my last Sfarim blog post, the grandson of Rav Simcha Zella Grieger, the Dayan of Brisk, one of the only people alive who can still tell us about Brisk. I also went out for lunch, and they have this, they had this like newspaper, and I was looking at it, one of these Haredi papers, and they're talking about Matzitza B'Peh, and you have these statements there, like, you know, it's still in the news, I don't know why it's still in the news, but someone just makes a blanket statement that, you know, although there are opinions that permit Matzitza, not B'Peh, you know, today, the overwhelming majority of Gedol Yisrael say we have to continue doing the same way. We've spoken in previous classes how the Hasidic influence has made itself felt in the Haredi world, even on the Litvisha world. But this is just such a crazy statement. In Lithuania, it was the exact opposite. The standard position of the Rabbanim was that Matzitza B'Peh is not an obligation. It's a nice minhag if you want to do it, but it's not an obligation at all. And they all were mutter using these tubes, if you thought it was important to use the tubes. This newspaper was saying that that God protects us. They said, they quoted a thing in the Talmud, that God protects the simple, and that we have our holy sages who've told us that we don't need to be concerned about this, and that this is... I mean, I don't know who their poskim are. I mean, this wasn't just the Hasidic world. This seemed to be literature people talking. So, it's not just Rav Chaim Hirshenson here. This is Rav Chaim Soloveitchik said don't use the Matzitza B'Peh. I mean, this is, if there's an issue. So, you don't need Rav Chaim Soloveitchik. This was some Hungarian, issue that they wanted to turn this thing into a part of the mitzvah. And not just Matzitza, that you have to do it with the Peh. So, again, we don't need Rav Chaim Hirshenson to say this. Who were some of the poskim? Rav Yitzchok Chonitz Vector, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, the Chazon Ish. I mean, can you get any more? There's a whole sefer. You can get it on HebrewBooks.org now, written by the Rav of the Mohel of London in the 19th century, who quotes all this. But you don't need the Litvisha poskim. You have the Chasam Sofer. But this was in Lita, in Lithuania. If there was any concern whatsoever that there would be a problem, they'd use the tube. And, of course, in Germany they used the tube. The Hasidim didn't use the tube. They have a mystical thing. But a Lithuanian Torah mind cannot grasp such a concept that there's some sort of mystical thing here. You have to use the mouth. First of all, look in the Gemara. It's obvious it's a medical issue. And fine, and now it's minhag, but there's no rule that it has to be with the mouth, and no one in the Lithuanian Torah world, that I don't know of any Lithuanian Torah scholar who ever said that there's an issue that you must use Matzitza B'Peh, ever. Rav Kook writes about it, the Rav Herzog writes about it. I've never heard of any Lithuanian posek who says that there's an idea that it has to be with the mouth. So yes, you need to do mitzitza, but they could use the tube. So you don't need him. Okay. The Hamis Derona article is what I was quoting was volume 3, pages 295 to 96, but it was in, if you see the Mr. Derona, it goes on for about 7 issues. He published these small issues of maybe 20 pages, and he would publish them every month, so it continued on and on. And but if you go to page 295 and 296, you'll see, but it start at the beginning, it's called Kavod Nashim or something like that, and it's all about women's issues. Ferguson wrote a psak detailing how women could and should be given aliyahs. Well, where is this, Chaim? Because it's not in the Malki Bakodesh. To my... are you sure? I mean, maybe it is in the Malki Bakodesh. Maybe I'm forgetting it. I didn't go through the Malki Bakodesh in preparation. I just, for the class, I didn't go through every... I do not recall that at all. But look for it. It might be in his tshuva about some of the issues, women's issues, about voting, where he just throws it in. But I don't recall that. If he just throws in the Maharam or others that talk about women, they can get an aliyah in a place where there's only kohanim and all that, that's not the same thing as saying, as describing how to do it, and this is a practical option. Please email me if you find it and let me know, because I don't have any recollection of that. It's not like it was an issue at all. There were people in pre-modern times who spoke about women getting aliyahs. I mentioned the Italian posek from the 1600s who mentions it. And you have the Maharam Rutenberg and others. Look in Daniel Sperber's book, his Hebrew book, on calling where he gives the reason why he permits women to get aliyahs. By the way, those who want to hear his logic, not his halachic logic, his ideological reasons, why he felt it was important, as Chaim Hirschenson, to keep these people in the fold. Because you have all these feminists who were really going to leave Orthodoxy, and he felt it was important to keep them in the fold and give this permission to them in his own shul. He's the rav of a shul in the old city. They don't give women aliyahs. But he felt it was important to give this psak so that these people would not totally leave. On the Torah in Motion website, if you go to where they say sell MP3s, on the right-hand side, you have a number of free MP3s, including the one from me, from Rav Cook, which has the problems in it. You have Sperber interviewed by Elliot Malamet. And I guarantee any of you who listen to it, you'll find one of the most fascinating interviews. Not just for his reasoning, his discussion of why he permitted this, but his life story, growing up in England, getting the classical education. He didn't even speak about his years in India. You know, he traveled all across India on an elephant. For a couple of years, he was, I think 2 years, he was in India, going all around the country. But to listen to his story and his life, it really is, they have many great interviews on Torah in Motion. This, I think, is perhaps the best. If you haven't heard it, Simcha, listen. And I will say, I've never been to one of these shuls where they call women up for aliyahs. And they don't have them around here, so I don't think I ever will. But after listening to him and his justification, it's really hard to... in my opinion, to find reason to oppose for those communities what he was doing. But I strongly encourage all of you to download it and while it's still free and listen to it. But you have to hear this, Simcha, his interview with Elliot Malamet. It really is, it's incredible. Okay, his view on machitza, or Chaim Hirschenson, or Sperber? Sperber. Those minyanim have a complete machitza. And when the woman does her thing, and she's on her side of the mechitza. Hirschenson doesn't mention mechitza. Again, this wasn't an issue. No one was talking about getting rid of the mechitza. He didn't write about it. He is the sort of postsake, however, that if he was alive today, he probably could argue, you don't need a mechitza. There's no mechitza mentioned in Shulchan Aruch, etc. However, he could not be a postsake today. Because with his ideology today, he'd either have to be in the conservative movement, or he'd have to say, well, I'm not going to write this way because then they'll throw me out of Orthodoxy. But before the conservative movement, there was a lot more flexibility allowed. He could go off in these directions and he'd be regarded as an eccentric or as a left-wing halachic figure. Today, someone who writes like this He's all, no matter how long his beard is, doesn't matter. He's left the fold. He's in the new movement. So I don't think you can have a post-ache like Chaim Hirschenson today, because he would the community would no longer regard him as in the fold. Exactly. The analogy is Eliezer Berkovitz. Berkovitz tried to do what Hirschenson did, and same with Rachman. Over time, they'll be pushed out, and precisely because there is another community, they'll be regarded as belonging to the other one. So Hirschenson, he would not work today. There's still his approach is still very interesting. No, I wouldn't say he'd be to the left of Yeshiva Chovei Torah. I think he'd be in Yeshiva Chovei Torah. That would be the sort of place he would be in. You can't say the issues today from then. It's different types of issues. But if you look at what he regards as important, these are not what are regarded today as important in centrism. On the other hand, he would be right in there, and he died in 35, right in there in 1950s, 1960s, modern orthodoxy. We're in a different type of orthodoxy today, where look what happened to Rachman and Berkovitz. They were mainstream in the 50s and 60s, and by the 80s and 90s, they're already on the left. Look at Lookstein and his father, mainstream in the 50s and 60s. Now they're regarded on the left, Mark Angel. I mean, orthodoxy's moved to the right. These people haven't moved left for the most part. Yeah, that is true. They used to be chumot that can't be accepted, the same as kulot. No, 100%. And, you know, if Chaim Hirschenson was alive today, he might say that you can't do certain of these things. Because the era, precisely because there's a conservative movement. When there's no conservative movement, you can come up with all sorts of halachic decisions. Remember what the Chasam Sofer says, Chadosh Asur Min HaTorah. It's precisely, the new is forbidden from the Torah. It's precisely because there's a reform movement that we can't do certain things that we could do without it, because where will it lead? The slippery slope. Hirsch couldn't do certain reforms with a small r precisely because of the slippery slope. It took the Orthodox rabbinate how many decades before they finally got around to prenuptial agreements, precisely because they were afraid, you know, the conservative movement started, etc., etc. So we can't say what Chaim Hirschenson would say if he was around today, because it's a completely different dynamic, and the response could be completely different. Could be Simcha, remains to be seen. Okay, so there's one more question. Thank you. Next week we will only have about 10 minutes tops on Rav Chaim Hirschenson. We'll finish up with him with biblical criticism, and then we will move into Rav Yitzhak Nissim, fascinating figure, the pride of Baghdad, eclipsed by Rav Avad Yosef, but there's a lot of interesting things to say about it. Okay, have a good week, everyone.